Blog Talk Radio.
I know you can't let us stay. If you were free, then you come out with me. And I know what you came here to do. Now bust it open, let me see you get loose.
It's going down for real.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Polar Opposites. That's the PM show right here on Blog Radio. And as always, I'm your host, Big T, and I'm joined by my main man, my friend, your friend, and soon to be everybody's friend, Mr. Cool Hand Phil. Phil, how are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic tonight, Terrence. Looking forward to hearing this weekly breakdown and ready to get into the topics that we are going to, I guess, basically debate tonight. I'm not going to call it fighting, but I guess we'll debate a couple things tonight, though.
Well, they do call it soap on officers for a reason, so we will definitely have an opportunity to get into my views, the right side, your views, the wrong side, every time you but without any further delay, we'll start this show like we do every single day. As a doctor, you can play the things every single day, and we're just glad you decided to spend a little bit of time with us right here on the PO Show. Phil, so much has happened in sports since we last spoke. Jimmy Butler won his 77th NASCAR race. The Kentucky Wildcats are still undefeated. In fact, right now, as we speak, they're vying for a all-time great 30-0 would be their best record in history. And also, since we last spoke, two games, LeBron James reminded us, and he's the greatest player on the planet. And then, 2 days later, Frank Randy reminded us that he's shooting. Talk about that. And what else has happened in sports world? Oh, there was a story that just broke, Phil, right up your alley. You recall Tiger Woods told the world that he would not come back to the game of golf until he felt that his game was ready. But then a story broke saying that he had been suspended by the PGA for 30 days. Of course, Tiger's people said that that story was nonsense, although the timeline syncs up perfectly. At the time that he announced his departure from the game, seems to line up perfectly with this supposed PGA suspension. But the story that probably got most of all the headlines over this past week, Phil, about a basketball program, let's just be honest, that we wouldn't normally talk about at all. Don't get me wrong, Vanderbilt's a great university for higher learning, but you just don't think Vandy when you talk basketball. However, they found themselves in the midst of controversy when the head coach, Coach Stallings, was caught on camera telling one of his players, and I quote, "I will effing kill you." Now, Phil, you and I talked back and forth about this a little bit. I, for one, was completely appalled by the coach's behavior, but you, like most people in the media and most people around the sport, didn't really take much exception to what happened. What was your take on that?
Yeah, you know, when I first heard about the story, it was just the headline, you know, that Stallings berated a player, you know, so, but once I saw it, you know, I felt like it was being made into a bigger deal than what it should. You know, I wouldn't call that berating a player. You know, I think he said, "Get over here and apologize," and then he made the comment. Now, what he said was absolutely wrong. I can't believe that Georgia just tied that game up going into halftime against Kentucky. But I felt like what he said was wrong. But at the same time, I felt like he said it in jest. And he even came out and said that he was wrong for it and apologized. So I don't know. When I heard the whole story, this kid had a history of doing these types of things, and I think he was so upset that this player had made the exact same mistake, something that they had just discussed recently, that he did it again. I think he was so upset and disappointed that he said something that he had absolutely no business saying. I mean, because you could categorize that as terroristic threatening. I mean, I think if you look at the context of it, you realize it's not terroristic threatening, but it is a very powerful thing to say, and he was wrong in saying it. But, I mean, I just think all the attention that it got, I don't know if it quite warranted that.
Well, you know, because I know you, because we've done this show this long, I can't say I'm necessarily surprised that you would say that. You typically side with the institution. You typically side with establishment. But I don't know how I don't understand how you and others can just passively give this guy a pass. It's not about that he came out and acknowledged that he was wrong. Sure, that's the bigger thing to do. The issue that I take mainly is that it never should have happened. Now, you just said that it was a situation where the player had done this type of thing before. But what did he really do, Phil?
Well, I mean, he taunted the player. And again, I don't know what was said. If you go back to earlier in the week, when those two teams played, I think it was Vanderbilt and Tennessee. Of course, that's an in-state rival. But after they had played the first game, I think it was a very close game. Tennessee won in the last seconds of the game. And Richardson, the guy for Tennessee, said, you know, we were just tougher, and that's why we won the game. And the player for, not Bradley, but the player from Vanderbilt. I can't think of it. Baldwin. I believe it's Baldwin. So Baldwin, earlier in the week, brought that subject up because they took offense to when that guy said that earlier in the year. So he made comments, you know, we're going to show them that we're, you know, not a weaker team, this and that, you know, and called Richardson out during the week. So the only thing I could think of is Stallings had a conversation, look, you know, if we win this game, I want everyone to handle it with class. I know we're upset about some comments that were made. So whenever we win, let's just shake hands and get off the court. I don't want anybody, you know, jawing it up or, you know, pointing anyone's face. Let's win with class and go about our business. Coaches have conversations like this with their teams all the time. So after it was over, the guy purposefully turned around and started clapping in that guy's face. Now, was it all, you know, exuberant and in his face and obnoxious? No, but you could tell he singled him out, that Richardson guy out, and clapped. So the biggest problem that I have with this, or at least the second biggest problem, is the coach for Tennessee. You know, why did he have to make the comment, why they're shaking hands in line? You know, why couldn't you catch the guy in the tunnel and say, hey, you know, this player did that? But to me, I didn't think it was a big enough situation to, you know, get ratted out on anyway. So, and I think that's why the coach, I don't think Coach Stallings even saw it. When that guy came up to him and made those comments, I think he believed that coach and thought, okay, if this guy is coming up and telling me this, then it must have been something pretty egregious, when it wasn't. And so that's the thing. I think Stallings overreacted because if another coach comes and tells you something, well, you're probably going to believe it. You know, why would this guy have any reason to lie? So I think he overreacted because I think he anticipated whatever his player did, it being worse than what actually took place. But the guy did taunt him. There's no question about that.
Well, I appreciate you being as efficient as you are and doing my job for me, because you brought out all the points that I wanted to make here. First and foremost, I don't understand why this has to be so much about the player. It's not about the player at all. The player wasn't caught on camera saying, I'll kill you. The player wasn't caught on camera making or threatening someone's life. So this shouldn't be about the player at all. This is all about the coach and the coach's reaction, and in your words, overreaction to what was a harmless situation. First, to call it taunting is a stretch. clapping your hands while another player walks by, that, I mean, that's a real reach to say that that's taunting, but let's pretend that it was. Your second point was Stallings didn't even see it for himself. So not only did he overreact to, you know, a simple act, he overreacted to something that he didn't even see for himself, which makes it that much worse. But the thing that I, the two things that I hate most about this, this whole deal, is, and all under the umbrella that they made it about the player when it wasn't about the player. One, if in fact you were so appalled as a head coach by his behavior, then how in the world can you possibly perceive that your behavior in the handshake line, berating the Baldwin in the fashion that he did in front of everybody else, how is that possibly any better? And then, even after you had the time to cool off, even after you had time to realize, okay, I've let this get out of hand, in the post-game press conference, how in the world can you spend the first 5 minutes still talking about the player? And I think it was unfortunate for Baldwin. Whether, and it's not even a matter of whether what he did, again, I'm using that term taunting extremely loosely, but even if you, even his taunting was the issue or what was the catalyst for all of this, that was a small, minute 30-second, he clapped his hands. Okay, fine. You want to scold him for that in the locker room? Go right ahead. You want to reprimand him for that at practice and run laps? Go ahead. That's fine. But berating him in the handshake line amongst his teammates and his fellow opponent, not cool. Telling, saying on national TV that you want to effing kill him, not cool. Going to your press conference and then spending the first 5 minutes going on and on about how much of a problem the player is, how much he needs to grow up, none of that is cool, Phil. And I was disappointed to find out the next day that the university decided not to spend, and as far as we know, no disciplinary action took place towards the coach at all.
Yeah, now I would have been fine if they would have suspended him for a game or whatever, and I think they should have. I mean, I can't really justify that, but I have absolutely no issue with what the coach did in the press conference because, again, if the player would have been clapping as he walked by the other player, no one would have noticed it. I wouldn't have said anything. That player has every right. But what he did is he clapped, and then he turns his body as the other guy goes past. So that was still an immature move. Well, hey, it is what it is, Tim. So I have no problem. If that coach has talked to his players about that being poor sportsmanship, then there's nothing wrong with that because that's what the story was is, you know, why did he make those comments? And he said, look, he's got a lot of growing up to do. He's done this before. We've told him not to do that, and he did it again. So all you're doing is explaining. Now, I'm not saying that justifies him making those comments. I'm just saying I have no problem with him explaining what happened because I'm sure he was asked, hey, what happened in that line? Well, you can't just say, well, I said something that I shouldn't have. Oh, well, okay, why did you say it? Well, because, I mean, you have to explain yourself. So I have no issue whatsoever with him explaining why he was so upset with Baldwin because it was taunting. Now, is it something that he should be penalized for as far as getting a game suspension? No, it wasn't that bad. But it was still taunting, and he knew he shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, well, you were saying that, and you are taking that approach because the kid's last name is Baldwin. If it was your kid that was playing D1 ball and the head coach on national TV yelled at your kid, I'm going to effing kill you, you would not be saying right now, well, poor sportsmanship, I don't have a problem with it. You would have a problem with it. And you know what? Just about every parent in America would have a problem with it. So, you know.
Well, I'm not going to go that far and say that. I mean, whenever these kids, if I had a son that played for a coach, I would know what that relationship was. Baldwin came out and said, hey, I have absolutely no problem with what Coach did. So if Coach didn't have a problem with it, I'm sure Daddy didn't have a problem with it. I mean, if Player didn't have a problem with it, I doubt Daddy did. So, man, I think if you have a relationship and your son is playing for somebody and you know that they care about your son, now they may say some dumb things. I've had coaches that have said dumb things to me, and my dad was never upset about it because he's like, well, you should have done what the coach told you, son. And that's what I'm saying. Society is not like that anymore. Society is about, oh, don't talk to poor Johnny like that. You can't yell at poor Johnny. I mean, I've had, playing in junior high, one of my fellow players got choked on the sideline because the coach told him, all right, they're going to press us. Do not run to the corner to catch the ball on the inbound pass. That player ran to the corner, caught the ball on the inbound pass, got trapped. We had to call a timeout, and he choked him. After the game, he went to apologize to the kid's dad, and he said, hey, I was upset too. You know, you told him not to go to the corner, and that's what he did. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. When you know these coaches care about your son, they're going to do dumb things if they get upset. Now, I probably would be upset if a coach put their hands around, you know, one of my players' neck. But it's just a different time now, and you're a part of that part of society that it's just, oh, you know, everybody's got to be so PC. You know, in sports, you were probably upset with the coach at Texas Tech that told the kid to go into the barn because he said he was tired. You know, but that's just old school coaching. I mean, we've heard about the Manning guy. When he was at Ole Miss, one of the players broke their leg, and he's like, Coach, I broke my leg. And the coach said, well, how do you know? You're not a doctor. Get him out of here. I mean, if that would have happened today, that coach would be fired, but it's just a different – environment. And I know we live in that now, and Stallings has to answer to that type of scrutiny in today's society, but I just don't – I mean, what did you want to happen to Stallings? I mean, if you're sitting there, what would you do? Since you're the one that's unhappy, what can we do to make you happy about the situation? What would you do?
Plain and simple. You know, I think that there should have been some type of punishment – some type of punitive of actions taken against the coach, whether that was a one-game suspension, whether that was a fine, you know, whatever it was, because not doing it, the problem that I have is when you do nothing, you are saying that that behavior is okay, and it's not. That's my point. That behavior is not okay, and when you do nothing, you're saying that it is. So you want to tell me that 30 seconds of air play, you want to tell me that was an incredible recruiting tool? No, that's not an incredible recruiting tool. You can't go into the home and play those 5 minutes and to a parent and a prospective athlete and have them come away from thinking, oh, yeah, I definitely want my child to play there. Because I'll put you on notice right now, Phil, and the rest of D1 America. Any child of mine that's playing D1 sports, I wish a coach would tell him I will effing kill you. And it's on and popping, okay? I don't care right, wrong, or indifferent. There is a certain amount of decor that needs to be upheld in dealing with people. I wouldn't care if it's sports. I wouldn't care if it's business. There's just some things you don't do. And telling somebody on national TV, I'm going to effing kill you, that's not cool. See, I really feel that there's more to this story that we'll never know, because I just for the life of me can't understand how a coach can get that mad in a win. I just don't understand how you get that mad in a win for something that you didn't even see. So I just feel like that there's more to the story. There was something brewing underneath, because I just don't see now if they had lost the game. Then I could understand emotions overflowing. But you won the freaking game, you know? So it would seem like to me that would be the overruling, the overruling emotion would be some sort of exuberance over winning the game. But we see this everywhere, Phil, and it just seems like to me coaches, administrators, they're not held to the same standards as players because of the exact same weak Phil and the pro ranks. Dallas Mavericks point guard Rajon Rondo, who's known to be a little bit fiery, who has definitely had some history with being stubborn and getting into shouting matches with his head coaches, Apparently, in an in-game situation where he's taking the ball at the court, that the Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle shouts out a play that he once ran. Rondo completely ignored him. You would assume that he would have heard him, but he completely ignored him. Coach took exception to it, called a timeout. Rondo coming to the bench, and you can see it as plain as day. He tells Coach Carlisle, "F you." Now, was he right? Of course he was not right. Was he justified in doing that? No. No way, no how. And did he get punished for it? He most certainly did. He got benched for the rest of that game and suspended the next. And that's how that becomes a non-story, because it was handled. Because now Rick Carlisle has set a precedent for the rest of the team to say, hey, that's not how we do things here. I call a play, you run it. You don't, you get put on the bench. You speak to me in a manner such as that, you find yourself on one-game suspension. Phil, that's how things are supposed to be handled. And I don't understand why, in the opposite, when it's the coach, when it's the administrator, when it's the owner, when it's the executive, I don't understand why that person isn't dealt with the same way.
Well, I mean, from my views on that, I don't think you should treat players and coaches the same way. That wouldn't make any sense. I mean, the boss always gets treated different than the underling. I mean, that's just how society works. So I don't know why you would treat...
It's people. That's why.
Well, I mean, I don't think that matters. I mean, if you go across the NFL and you mic all these coaches up, I guarantee you they use the F word against players and say, you're going to F and do this, you're going to F and do that. But if a player was to come to the coach and say, look, we're going to run this F and play, we're going to do that, I think you would have a problem. And so I think that's what you're missing. You can't treat all the players the same as you would treat a coach. That wouldn't make any sense. I just don't know how you can get away with that and say, oh, yeah, you know, we're going to treat everyone as equals, because that's not how an hierarchy works. I mean, I guarantee you the owner of a team is going to talk to a coach much different than a coach can talk to the owner. I mean, I just don't think you can get away with things. And if an owner did something and said something very offensive to a coach, I don't think that owner is going to face any type of disciplinary action from the league. But if the coach was to do something that was disrespectful to the owner, well, guess what? He's probably going to get fined, because the owner can do that. So I don't have a problem with the way things have played out. But again, I've already told you, I think Stallings should have faced a suspension or a fine, but as far as coaches getting away with more in respect to players, I have no problem with that whatsoever. You have to have a leader, and you have to have the followers. You can't have a bunch of leaders walking around. There's no way society or sports or anything could work in that type of system.
And that's fine. I'll give you that. But I guess my point is, in a situation where the person knows that they were wrong, Rondo knew he was wrong when he told the coach, F you. Rondo knew he was wrong when he ignored the coach's wishes to run a play, and he was punished for it. Coach Stallings knows he was wrong, and he wasn't punished for it. That's where I'm at.
Right. But here's the thing.
Have
you ever heard of Stallings in the past having any type of misstep like this? I don't remember. I'm not saying that he hasn't. I don't remember. Yeah. Maybe you could remind me. But when it comes to Rondo, I mean, the last coach that he played for, he punched him in the face. And, you know, and that's why he had to leave Boston. So, again, it always goes back to your reputation. I see players all the time, you know, get heated on the sideline and getting shouting matches with their coaches. I mean, you see receivers do that with the offensive coordinator. They don't get suspended games. You know, it just goes away. But if they have a history of it and it continues, well, then that's when you start getting suspension. So, again, I don't know if Stallings has ever cursed out a player in public. I'm not sure. But we know of Rondo's issues. And I don't think this was the first time that Carlisle has said, hey, he wasn't running the plays that I called. I don't think that was the first night. So I think that could have built up. And then when he made his outburst, that led to it. So So, I mean, I don't think every situation is just you can compare it apples to apples and say, hey, this is the exact same thing, and let's look at it in the same light as we would another situation.
Yeah. Well, and that very well may be true, and you're right that with Rondo, there's definitely been some history there. It's definitely been a situation that looked like it had been brewing, and that's what I'm saying about the Pauling Baldwin situation. I just find it hard to believe that coach could have been that incensed in a win about something as benign as clapping. And even if you want to say he was clapping in the other player's face, which I am not prepared to say that he was clapping in his face, I just feel like there's something else there. There's something that must have been brewing. And, boy, speaking of brewing, I mean, you got to put them on upset alert there in Athens because the Bulldogs are hanging tough with the undefeated Wildcats, 37 all early in the second half. And it looks like it's a defensive struggle as both teams have yet to even score 40 points in this particular match. But we'll keep you posted as that game goes on. But Kentucky, of course, off to their best start in school history and in one of the, you know, could go down in history as one of the best streaks that college basketball has seen. And they are definitely reigning supreme right now in this season. Now, in the NBA, for years still, King James has reigned supreme as not just the best player on his team, not just the best player in the league, but arguably the best player on the planet. And he kind of put everybody on notice when he put on a one-man show. Kind of like, we talked about it last week, and I told you that one of the reasons that I favored Cleveland to come out of the East is because of LeBron and his ability, when needed, to simply take over a game. And when they played Golden State last week, that's exactly what happened. He pretty much just picked the team up and put him on his back and took over that game. Just reminding everybody that he is the greatest player in the game today. But then, Phil, last night, while on the road playing in Houston, Cavs come to town with an ailing Kyrie Irving. Kevin Love didn't play. And the game was still competitive, Phil. The game was still close. And, in fact, with the game on the line, LeBron James misses two free throws, in essence costing the Cavs the win. And the word on the street immediately following the game is that LeBron James is a choke artist and that he chokes in the big moment. Now, in your opinion, and then the rhetoric goes on from there that he's losing a step, he's not the same King James he was in Miami, and, you know, he's washed up, has been, so forth and so on. Now, we know how you feel about his game, but I think you can probably be objective in this. I'll ask the question anyway. Is there something there? Is LeBron losing a step?
Well, I mean, let me get this straight. So you said in one game against Golden State,
he put
the team on his back, 42 points.
Yep.
The next game, he's missing free throws to lose the game. It's almost like you're saying he's two-faced. Like Harvey Dent, you know, that's his nickname that I gave him, Harvey Two-Face. So I'm glad that you recognize this fact as well. And I said this, you know, even last year after the finals. I mean, that's when I finally denounced King James. But I started to see that, you know, that if he wants to turn it on, he can. Or there's just some nights that whatever it is, he just can't figure it out and he looks pathetic. Now, I think he had a decent game against Houston, even though, you know, he had to take a ton of shots just to get to the 35 or 37 points, whatever he had.
Right.
But, you know, but you have to realize, too, that in between that Golden State and Houston game, he sat out the game. You know, so again, that just boggles your mind. In today's NBA, LeBron still, you would consider in the prime, a young player. He can't even play a full season. You hit 48, you have to sit out a game, and then you have enough energy to hit 37. So why, and take, you know, 35 shots or whatever he took. So I just don't understand why you needed the game off if you had that much energy in the first place. But this is not the first time that LeBron has been labeled choke artist. You know, we've seen that before when they said he just couldn't hit the big shots at the end of a game. And I think he's made a few since that time, so that label, it just hasn't been sticking as well as it used to. But, you know, it's just one game, so, I'm not going to make as big of a deal about it, but I would like to check back with you in the playoffs and let's discuss Harvey Dent again. But, no, I'm not going to make a lot of excuses or paint this into a bigger picture than what it really is. But, you know, I think he was 3 of 11 from the free throw line. So he had a dismal night from the free throw line the whole night. You know, so that didn't change at the end of the game. But anyway, I don't know. I'm just not a big LeBron fan right now. But I think you're right, though. I think his game, and I don't know if you're arguing that, but I think his game is going to start taking – some steps back in these next few years. And I even said, you know, I think he's going to start getting hit with that injury bug. You know, it may be a knee or – I'm not saying it's going to be as serious as like a ACL, but I just think he's going to get banged up more and more and his game is going to slow down from what we're used to seeing him over the past few years.
Right. Well, so a couple of things there to react to. The first, you know, as far as the choke artist label, I think that's unfair. It is one game. And, you know, missing those free throws, having a dismal night from the line, does that erase what he did two nights before? No way, no how. You know, if he reminded you that he was the man two nights ago, he still is. Is it unfortunate that it happened that way? Of course. Is it unfortunate that, you know, that he missed those free throws and that's what cost him the game? Of course. But a couple of things I want to remind you of that you brought out. A, he didn't play the night before. He rested in the previous game. And again, as I mentioned, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love did not play. So I think it was a matter of rhythm. And I think even in the post game, I think that's what LeBron said. He said he could never get into a rhythm in this game. And I think that's what you saw. I don't think, and I'm not, I mean, look, conventional wisdom tells you that at some point his game will decline. I just don't think that's happening today. I think that he's in a situation with, you know, new team members, new coach, new system, and he, like everybody else on that team, is that they're trying to find their way and they're trying to gel. You know, LeBron James doesn't play the same game when Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving are on the floor as opposed to when they're not. So he hasn't, quite honestly, think about it. LeBron hasn't had to be, quote-unquote, the man since he left Cleveland the first time. You know, he left Cleveland and immediately went to Miami with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. He has to be, quote-unquote, the man. And then he comes back to Cleveland with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love. So in a game where those guys didn't, and neither of those guys played, I mean, to him it was probably reminiscent of his first tour duty in Cleveland. And, again, he hasn't had to be that guy in a long time, so he couldn't find his rhythm. And I think it's as simple as that. You know, you've got the, you know, those idiots in Houston, they even are running around calling James Harden the new King James. I mean, you know, I'm sure that sells papers and great, but let's not be ridiculous, you know. LeBron James has not passed the torch. And if he is passing the torch, let's be clear, it's not to James Harden. Okay. You know, give me a Steph Curry, give me a Russell Westbrook, but he's not passing it to James Harden. Not that James Harden doesn't have game. He's, you know, the league's leading scorer. You know, and I think when we talk about him in regards to the 3-point competition, I think we talked about it then, saying that James Harden, he's a great scorer of the basketball, but I don't really see him as anything else. I don't see him as a great shooter. I don't see him as – I don't even see him as a league MVP, you know, but he is a great scorer of the basketball. I've digressed a little bit there. But you're right. That's an argument that we will definitely have to revisit as we get deeper into this NBA season, as we get deeper into these playoffs. But I tell you, these Georgia Bulldogs are getting deeper into this game, and they are still hanging around. Still just hanging around. 43-41, Kentucky with the ball, 14 minutes left in the game. Again, we will keep you posted as this game goes on, but, you know, we'd said before that this was the best shot for Kentucky to lose on the road at Georgia in a situation that the computer said that they had the greatest percentage chance of winning. Yep. We'll see if that happens, which brings me to a topic. We didn't go through this in the production meeting, but it's something that I've been meaning to get on air. You know, in the pro game, you and I both acknowledge that TNT studio show with Kings and Jets men, Charles Barkley and Shaq, probably one of the best pregame, halftime, postgame shows of all the major sports, more so than football, more so than anything you see with baseball. That crew, I mean, they get it in, and they do a great job. It's entertaining. You learn a little something. You laugh a little bit. You know, it's just good TV. Well, you know, we talked last week about Shaq's rant about the Hack of Shaq, you know, that it's called, you know, basketball, not basket strategy. Well, the rant previous to that was by Charles Barkley talking about that analytics in sports, particularly in basketball, he said that it was all hogwash. It had no place. In fact, he said anybody that's focusing on analytics in basketball are just guys that didn't get dates, didn't get girls, that couldn't play basketball. So they came up with analytics to feel important. So the question I wanted to ask you, excuse me, do you agree with Barkley as far as analytics? Is there a place in sports for analytics, or is it just something that some guys made up so they could feel like they were part of the game?
I do. Man, this crowd, this atmosphere at Georgia is not – I mean, they just took the lead here. This is a good game. Speaking of atmosphere, have you seen the video that's been going around about the pregame at Maryland, their basketball? Have you seen that? Okay, I need to send that link to you. But, yeah, as far as analytics, I mean, I think it does have a place in the game. I mean, I do share some of the sentiments that Barkley has, and maybe he took it further than he believes, or maybe he believes every word that he says. But, you know, I feel like sometimes you can make too big of a deal about some of the analytics, and you can dive too deep in because you still have to play the game. I mean, all that stuff is on paper, and I think if you're a coach, I think it is good to look at some of those and if you can find tendencies of a player because, I mean, baseball has been doing this forever. Even football, they do it as well. I think basketball has just been one of the last sports to pick this up. And I think it's less I think it's more difficult to do it in basketball than it is in other sports. Because, number one, in football, you know, you kind of have a chance. You have 40 seconds between each play to figure out what you want to do. So you can look at the defense and say, okay, this defense is set up in this manner. So we have a 60% likelihood that this play is going to work. You know, you have time to think about that. And I think in basketball it's a little bit different because things happen so fast. But if you know that a player, if you can look at the analytics and a player shoots a different percentage from one spot to the other, then you know you can defend that spot a little bit different. Or if you know if one player is on the floor that it results in X number of fast break opportunities, then you know when that player is in the game, you have to make sure that you have a player that gets back. So I think it does have a place in the game. But again, I don't know to what extent, like, you know, how far you want to dig into it, because then I think you're thinking about too many things other than just, hey, let's just match up and play real basketball. But, you know, right. I don't agree completely with Charles, but I absolutely think that that there is a spot for it in the game. And plus, man, when I watch SportsCenter, I mean, I love seeing, you know, the analytics that they put on, you know, different players that, hey, this player did this. It's the first, you know, so different stats and all that. So I don't know. I really do think it has a place, and I think you can use it to give yourself an advantage in any contest. So what is your take on it? I mean, do you feel like me and feel like, hey, yeah, it definitely can give you an advantage, or is it just all hogwash?
Yeah, I would – again, I may not go all the way to the left of Charles Barkley on it, but I would probably tend to side more with his side of this argument than the other. Analytics, I've always felt like, whether it's sports, business, whatever, analytics definitely tell a story, and it's up to you to interpret what that story really is and what it means and how you want to use that information. You know, you mentioned baseball's been doing it for years. You know, baseball took analytics, realized that it told a story, and then they made decisions. They made player decisions,
money,
they made personnel decisions based on those analytics. You know, football definitely is getting more involved into analyzing trends and so forth and so on. I think the reason that basketball maybe has been slow to the party, or why people like Charles Barkley, or even myself for that matter, may say that analytics has no place in basketball, is because the sample size in basketball is so much different. In basketball, if you've got, I mean, you're talking about one player makes up 20% of your offense and 20% of your defense. That
right.
doesn't happen in football. That doesn't happen in baseball. So what I mean by that is you can have all the analytics in the world, but if you got LeBron James playing in one of those five spots, you can throw it out the window. You got to figure out how to handle him. If you got Russell Westbrook playing one of those five spots, all the analytics in the world is not going to slow that man down. And they just have that much influence on the game, you know, 20%
right.
on both sides of the ball. And you don't see that in any other – so it's – oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Boy,
that was a shot. He just went Trey Burke on him, man.
Hey, look, as quick as I just said, analytics don't mean nothing in basketball. The computer said that just to win.
That's a great point about Russell Westbrook. I mean, because, again, the analytics can tell you when he's on the court, they get, like I said, they get this many number of fast breaks and they do this, but it's not because you don't know that it's coming. It's because
mm-hmm.
you just can't stop it. He's just that athletic. You know, you go back
exactly.
to the USC teams back in, like, the 60s and 70s, and they think
mm-hmm.
that the other team knew. This team has three plays. They're going to run,
right.
What was it called, student body left, student body right, and then they had a
yeah.
play up the middle. And they would call the play out at the line. The other team knew what was coming, but they still couldn't stop it because the other team was just that much more powerful. And they were just that good at what they did. So, you know, I think you're right about that in basketball. I mean, it's a little bit – it's easy to interpret the story, but it's a completely different thing to stop a player like Westbrook from doing what he wants to do just because he's faster than you are. And that's why the
mm-hmm.
analytics showed that, not because the other team wasn't diligent in trying to stop it.
Yeah, and, you know, and I'll go farther. Even in baseball, they call it Moneyball, where they went after these guys, statistically speaking, that weren't great. They weren't the best at any one thing. They were these marginal ball players, and they built these whole team around these marginal ball players. They could pay them less, yada, 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 so forth and so on. And all of a sudden, it was great. But I would submit, Phil, that that's not why those teams won. I would submit that you got a bunch of guys together that people had given up on, that had chips on their shoulder, and that's why they were good, and that's why they played well, because they had something to prove, you know? What they did, what the Oakland A's did, is nothing different than what Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks are doing. They don't have big name superstars. They got these marginal guys that have been told all their life they couldn't do it, they weren't good enough, wasn't fast enough, wasn't big enough. But you got Pete Carroll and a coaching staff that believes them, and, man, Georgia wants to win this game. they want to win this game. 54-47, Georgia with the ball, 9 minutes and 35 seconds left. Colley Stein just had a turnover, giving the ball back to Georgia with the lead. And, I mean, I don't know how many timeouts Calipari's got left in his bag of tricks, but he needs to call a timeout and slow this thing down because it's about to freight train any second now and get completely, totally out of hand.
If Georgia wins this game, though, it's gonna prove that analytics does have a place in sports because, you know, they said Georgia had the best chance, and I didn't agree with that. When I heard that, I was thinking my Arkansas Razorbacks had the best chance. You know, they were ranked 18th at the time, had won 7 games straight, and I felt like they were going to have the best chance. And now that game was in Lexington, but, you know, even though we lost by 17, the game was never that close. I mean, it was an absolute blowout from the word go. So if Georgia pulls this out, I got to say – these analytic guys, you know, maybe they didn't get the girl in high school, but they know what's going on right now.
You know, and I wish I was there because, oddly enough, even having this conversation, Charles Barkley is at this game. The camera panned through the crowd. Sure enough, Barkley is at the game. I wish I could go to him afterwards and ask him if, in fact, Georgia won. Hey, Charles, is analytics still hogwash? Because you're right. The computers said that Georgia had the best chance to win, albeit small, with only a 14% chance, but it was higher than anybody else's.
Right.
And it'll be interesting. Now, I've watched this Kentucky team get in a hole like this before earlier this year, Phil, and it looked like, you know, going the same way this game was. But, man, somewhere along the line, let's call it the 4 or 5 minutes to go mark, they locked in on defense, and the other team, I mean, they, you know, the last 4 or 5 minutes of the game, they may have gotten a basket. So, still a lot of ball to be played, but we will see how that goes. But, yes, so if you're listening to this show, you need to tune in and turn that on because it looks like what we've got going on right now is an instant classic. But let's jump ship real quick, Phil. I want to jump to some stories in the NFL. What's going on right now in the NFL, there was a lot of talk about the use of the franchise tag on several players, and most notably in Dallas. The decision was, would they use the franchise tag on their star running back, DeMarco Murray, or their star wide receiver and somewhat troubled Dez Bryant? And news came down today, or yesterday even, news came down that they decided to use the franchise tag not on the running back, but on the wide receiver. If you're Jerry Jones and you got to make that call, do you make the same call? Do you think that was a proper use of the franchise tag, putting it on Bryant as opposed to putting it on the running back, Murray?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Dez Bryant has proven himself that he is a premier NFL receiver, and he's done that multiple years. And DeMarco Murray, even though he had a tremendous season, I believe he led the NFL in rushing this year, even though he had a tremendous season, number one, the NFL is moving away from being a running back league, and it's more about the quarterback and the receiver position because you have to have that threat on the other side of the ball. It doesn't matter how good you are as a quarterback. You need those threats at the receiver position. But DeMarco Murray has not proven that he is this premier back. So I think they could probably still get a deal done with Murray, but and he's going to get paid no matter if he stays in Dallas or if he goes to another team. So I think that was the right decision. But if you would have told me that they had done it for Murray, I would have understood that as well because he's a younger running back. He still has, I assume, a lot of miles left on his legs. So I could have argued that that was a good decision. But if you weigh out the facts, I mean, I'd say it was probably a 55-45% percent favor in Dez Bryant's case. And, mm-hmm. you know, you talked about Dez being troubled, and he has been, and he's had his issues, and I think he still could have issues. Sometimes I think he is disruptive on the sideline. But for the most part, Dallas has done a very good job at maintaining – Dez Bryant and keeping him out of trouble, and he's done a good job himself at remaining out of trouble with that support from the Cowboys. So, you know, he's going to keep maturing as a man and as a player. So I think it was the better decision for them to make sure they hang on to him this year instead of it being DeMarco Murray.
Yeah, and I'm completely look at it from the other side, and I go the other way on it. I mean, granted, they had to make a decision on the two. You know, you got Murray, you want him back. You got Bryant, you want him back. But it's for that reason, though, Bill, that I felt like they should have used the tag on the running back as opposed to the wide receiver. And the reason I say that is, you know, when you franchise a player, pretty much
that next year.
That's it. Because they're not going to sign.
Yeah.
Well, the deal is they're not going to sign with you because most times the player sees it as an insult that you didn't want to give him a deal, long-term deal. You didn't want to give him his money. Although they do get the average of the top five that next year, but very rarely do you see that player come back and sign a long-term deal. So when you are franchising a player, you use that tag on that player, you know, for all practical purposes, that's his last year. So why not use that on a running back who's going to have a short career anyway? We know the average running back lasts 3 years. DeMarco Murray, this would have been his third year, I believe, with the team. Like you said, he hasn't necessarily proved himself, although last year was a breakout season. So franchising for less money. Because let's face it, running backs, the top five, the average of the top five running backs is going to be less than the top five receivers. So I felt like they could have saved themselves some money on the cap this year, give themselves some time and some money, freed up some money to work out a long-term deal with Dez Bryant. Because if you were committed to Tony Romo in such a way by paying him all that money, then you should be committed to giving him some weapons on the outside. And, you know, she knows about Dez Bryant.
But with the franchise tag, doesn't that mean that he was a restricted free agent this year, correct?
Right.
Dez Bryant? Okay, so, I mean, I wonder if they were thinking there was no way, you know, with the cap space and the players that they want to bring in, that there was no way they would be able to match. Because I think if you're a restricted free agent, if another team offers you, you know, $14, $15 million a year, then you can leave – unless your current team matches it or beats the deal. Is that correct?
That's it. That's correct.
Okay, so I wonder if the Cowboys thought, okay, we know how valuable Dez is, and we know what we want to accomplish this season, so we're going to have to put the franchise on him, even if we lose him, because we don't feel like we're going to be able to make the moves in the offseason and with the draft if we have to pay Dez, you know, whatever that market value is that they believe. So, I mean, I wonder if that's the way they were looking at it because, you know, just to your point about whenever you franchise tag someone, it seems like that next year they always go to a different team
mm-hmm.
because they didn't get the long-term deal. But we also see when a team, usually when they win a Super Bowl, then that next year that team gets blown up because they made some of those similar moves that the Cowboys just did, you know, where they
right.
did the franchise tag. Some people were in the final years of the contract that they were coming up on free agency. So this may be what's going to happen to the Cowboys. You know, maybe this is their very last ditch effort to keep Dez here, make some offseason moves, build a quality team that they can win a Super Bowl with, knowing, though, that once they do that, the team is going to get blown up because somebody is going to pay these other players more money, and they'll be unrestricted free agent.
Right. And there very well may be. I'm with you. I'd like to know what the logic and thinking was. You know, obviously they, you know, Jerry Jones and his staff, I mean, he's paying people a lot of money to make these types of decisions well above my pay grade. So, yeah, like you, I'd be interested in seeing what those decisions, you know, what the thought process was. Also, you know, if I go up the road in the NFC North, head on up to Detroit, I was also shocked that Detroit decided not to use the franchise tag on Ndamukong Suh. And basically, not necessarily gave him his walking papers, but clearly let him know that, hey, if you want to play somewhere else, have at it. You can get a better deal somewhere else, go get it. That was a surprise to me. Do you think that was a good non-use of the franchise tag, not using it on Ndamukong Suh?
You know, the only thing I could figure on that, I mean, maybe they're ready to get rid of Suh. You know, so maybe they're looking at trading him this year because, I mean, he hasn't exactly been the model citizen up there in Detroit. So if they feel like, hey, let's just cut ties, you know, you almost cost us the game by getting yourself, you know, I think they ended up waiving the suspension, but when he stepped on Rogers' leg, you know, he's kind of had a history of situations like this, so they may be ready to rid themselves of him, and so that's why they didn't place the tag on him. That way they can unload him onto another team and make some different moves that they feel like is going to be best for their organization. So I was not surprised by that, but he is a phenomenal talent. You know, I just think he has a little bit more baggage than what the Lions are willing to keep putting up with.
Yeah, I think you might be right. I felt like Detroit was sending a clear message to Suh and maybe even some of the other members of that defensive line, basically saying, you know, enough's enough. We're tired of dealing with the circus that goes along with. I think you hit the nail on the head. Here's where I would struggle with the decision, though, because on the field, I mean, he's been productive in terms of what you pay him to do. You know, he is a complete terror on that defensive front. So it's not like he's been unproductive, you know. And that's what you're paying for. You're paying for that type of production on the field. Yeah. He's giving you that. So I would struggle with that part of the decision. I would struggle with whether or not. You know, we could get by without him on the field, but it seems like in one of those, especially in the NFL, it seems like one of those rare instances where the off-the-field antics, although his antics seem to always take place on the field, but the on-the-field antics have somehow outweighed the on-the-field production. And it seems like, and some of that may be Jim Caldwell, you know, Jim Caldwell seems to be a soft-spoken individual, but he comes from that Tony Dungy coaching tree, and he may share those people. You know, it's funny, you know, you look at Tony Dungy as being a player's coach and so forth and so on, but if you just play for him, they'll tell you one of the strictest coaches that they've ever had. He just doesn't yell about it. So he's one of those coaches that lay out, hey, these are the rules. There's nothing to yell about. Either you follow or you don't. He's not here. That's his philosophy. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're starting to see some of the influence of Jim Caldwell, you know, in his second year at the helm, just basically that we're not going to tolerate Suh and his antics anymore.
Man, that was a bad foul. I mean, if you're going to foul, you got to give him a hard enough foul to make sure he doesn't make that basket. But, yeah, I agree, and I think that's the way it should be. I mean, I think you see a lot more of that in the NFL today. I wouldn't say as much as a player that's already on your team, but especially when it comes to the draft and those things, I think they start to look at how is this player going to do off the field. But, yeah, I think Caldwell may be moving towards that. Hey, we just don't feel like, you know, the conversation that we've had in the off season, I don't feel like he's going to be on board with what we want to accomplish and the manner in which we want to accomplish it. And so that may be the reason that they decided to cut ties. I mean, and it could be he re-signs anyway, but I just can't imagine. I feel like he'll get paid more money because there is a team out there that needs that productivity that you spoke of a lot more than the Lions do, or they're more willing to pay the price that it takes to get that productivity. So, yeah, I wasn't really surprised by that.
You talked about the bad fouls that George made on the defensive end, but making bad fouls where he don't block out on the missed free throw, and you know, they'll call his time to come in and dunk on the offensive board. And that bad foul didn't really push him worse. Like, also, George is still clinging to a slam, slight lead, deep into the second half, 4 minutes, 22 seconds left. At the line for a 1-1. Kentucky takes the possession arrow at this point. Just giving you the game reset. Two timeouts left for Georgia. One timeout left for Coach Calipari and his undefeated Wildcat. This game is going to come down to the wire. We said it before. The computers may have had it right. The computer said that Georgia had the best chance to win the game. And like I said, right now, deep into the half, a little much left to go. Georgia leads undefeated Kentucky 62-60. So you heard it here first, folks. You are up to alert. Get to your TVs, get to your smartphones and tablets, and tune in to the game. Kentucky just tied up 62-all. So we will definitely, when we talk to you again, about this time next week, we will definitely have to recap this game and talk about the highlights. At this point, I couldn't tell you which way it's going to go. It would be it'll be bittersweet for me personally because obviously I'm a Georgia fan, but I told you earlier that I picked Kentucky to go undefeated throughout the regular season, at least until the SEC tournament. So I'll take them to show up. But at the same time, I'll obviously be happy. They were unable to do with no one else. Had been able to do 29 other meetings. That pretty much brings this show to a close. What you heard, and you want to hear it on iTunes. And if you're active on Twitter, don't forget to follow us at The Official Radio. That's our Twitter handle. But hey, that's enough for this show. Thanks so much for listening to the PO right here on the blog. Right here. Good night.